Welcome to the Jewish Theological Seminary and to this book talk, which is sponsored by the Library of JTS. I'm David Kramer, the director of the library, and we have had this absolutely wonderful ongoing program over the course of the last several years sponsoring book talks dedicated to significant new books in Judaica, mostly from our faculty, including this evening, and then on some occasions notable books by others. Who have been kind enough to come and present their work. In order to introduce the book, I actually want to say a word about this book. I don't mean the book Sage Tales by Rabbi Burton L. Vysotsky. I mean this actual copy of the book. This is a book about stories, so I thought it would be nice to actually begin with a story. The story goes like this. My friend Hector Guzman and I, the Thursday night before the seminary began its break for Passover, we had the good fortune of getting tickets from our colleague Robbie Harris, a professor of Bible here, who is well known as the rabbi of the bleachers at Yankee Stadium. Well, you don't know him as that, but that's just because you don't go and hang out in the bleachers, right? But, you know, I mean, if you hung out in the bleachers, you would know that this is, in fact, the case. So over the years, being that I was leaving for break and I knew that I wanted to read this copy of the book on the break, I took the cover off of it because I didn't know how the bleacher bums would respond to the cover. And you have to write like that. And you have to be very, very careful when you go to the bleachers. And we sat down, the game commences the way, you know, games commence and go on. And behind us, I think, were four young, early to mid-20-ish women who you go to the bleachers and there's a pressure, right? You've got to be disgusting, unless you're really confident in yourself. These four young women realized that, in order to make their reputation in the bleachers, they needed to be sufficiently disgusting, and they began drinking. And the woman, I'm not even sure that's the right word, woman in this case, but, the female sitting behind us was drinking and drinking, and she proceeded to spill her first, 20, God knows how many ounce, $14 cup of beer all over those of us sitting in front. But fortunately, it missed me mostly. I think that one missed you too, right? And this copy of the book only got a few beer stains on it, right? It was sitting next to me on the bench. And so we figured, no harm done. And we went on to watch the game. Only a few minutes later, after she had repurchased her next, it's like the ones you get at Starbucks that are that large, coffee, but instead beer. So she proceeds to drink more, and in the middle of that one, spills it once again all over me and all over Hector and all over this copy of the book. If you don't believe me, you're welcome to come smell it. I just have to say that this book, it has many, many stories to tell. Not only the ones that Bert so expertly represents in the actual copy of the book, but the untold stories of the book are many as well. I'm telling you this only because it represents my commitment to reading every book before the author speaks, and that's why it was Yankee Stadium. And I do have to say that I did not become as inebriated reading this book as the woman behind me had been, but that's only because she was so drunk that you saw what happened when I described. It is a wonderful book, which those of you who are familiar with Bert's writing or teaching know that he has the capacity to teach as a scholar. I, as someone in the field, learns more than I could have guessed I would learn from reading this book, and yet it is as entertaining and accessible and in terms of the turn of language as seductive as any great book can be. And so those of you who have just bought it and not yet read it, enjoy it. You all came here to hear Professor Vysotsky, though, and not me, so let's hear his stories. And then afterward, you can share stories with one another and with us as well. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. I want to thank David not only for his gracious introduction. I'm trying to do this without breaking a computer. But I also want to thank him for being willing to have me here at this event. And despite the fact that we've hit mute and exit system, it still seems to be popping. What'd you do with it on Pesach?
You mean because I should have gotten rid of it because of the...
Yeah, it's like it's hummus. The whole book is hummus.
It's true. And it's soaked in, so I guess I was giving myself a liberal ruling on it.
Oh, yeah. Do you own that book?
Yes, but he did not eat it. So I want to start by telling a story, which goes back literally to the day I was ordained a rabbi, Sunday, May the 22nd, 1977. And that day was 2 days or 3 days or 4 days before Shavuot. And I walked out of my commencement the day I was ordained a rabbi. And in those days, we had our commencement at the Park Avenue Synagogue. And I walked out of the Park Avenue Synagogue, got in a taxi cab, and went to what was then called the Pan Am Building. It's gone through a few permutations since then. What's it now?
MetLife.
And in those days, in fact, it might have been one of the very last days, they had a helicopter pad on the roof. I went up to the roof. I got in a helicopter. I flew to Kennedy Airport. I was sartorially resplendent in a three-piece brown corduroy suit. It was the 70s. And in the various pockets of the suit, I had secreted Hebrew, Russian, mini dictionaries, Mug and Dovids on necklaces and armbands, and I went from Kennedy Airport to Moscow. And from Moscow, I went on one of those missions to help Soviet Jews who had applied to leave Russia to get to Israel. My job involved lying to everybody I knew because I couldn't tell people I was doing that. The Russians, when I applied for a visa, obviously would not have looked with favor on the fact that I was a young budding rabbi. So with my mother's connivance, she later regretted that she sent me off to Russia on one of these missions, but she connived with me. We told people that I was working at a jeweler who was her neighbor in Chicago. And sure enough, the Russian consulate called to ask, was I there? And they said, well, he's out for lunch. And that was all it took, thank God. I got to Russia, and I was actually assigned to visit Jews who had applied for visas to leave for Israel, had lost their jobs as a result. And they were called in the day refuseniks, although I only learned to my detriment that that's actually not what the Russians called them. Russian Jews didn't use that word because, oddly enough, even though it had Nick at the end, refuse is an English word. And I couldn't, like, I kept saying, you know, refusenik, like, nothing. I was sent to Soviet Asia. And so from Moscow, we flew in one of these Soviet planes. They had stewardesses who, I have to say, it was quite a, you know, it was the 1970s, and it was still before they were hiring stewardesses of any age. These, you know, so the American stewardesses were all these young things under 30, and the Russian stewardesses all could have played linebacker for the Chicago Bears. It was really just a remarkable difference in ethos. And the airplanes rattled away. There was no padding. I may as well have been in a military transport. And we touched down, and there I am, my first yontif as a conservative rabbi. I am in Bukhara. You've all seen the little Bukharan yarmulkes. Well, I know where they're from. And there I was in Bukhara, and we were supposed to see a certain family. Now, I'll just make up a name. Let's call them Goldberg, although they had a nice long Russian name. And the hotel we stayed in was the big hotel in Bukhara, four stories high, about 30 rooms, brown water coming out of the tap, and when you turn on the light bulbs, you could hear the microphones go on just like this one. It was really the old days. We had been briefed to not take a cab in front of the hotel because we were told in no uncertain terms that the cabbies in front of the hotel all worked for the KGB, and the last thing we wanted to do was compromise the families we were meeting. I actually visited one family in Bukhara, and while I was there, they got a phone call, and the guy was screaming in Russian, hung up the phone, turned to me, and said the three letters I didn't want to hear, KGB. So they knew I was there. They were keeping an eye on us, and we were trying to be clandestine. In my case, being clandestine meant I was walking around without a yarmulke. It didn't dawn on me, and it probably should have, but, you know, I was a kid. What did I know? That anyone in the town of Bukhara could have spotted me as an American, and that 95% of those people could pretty much make me as a Jew, whether I was wearing a yarmulke or not. And Bukhara, this was in May, it's hot, like 110 degrees in the shade. And I was then, as I am now, male pattern challenged, and I got a sunburn on my bald spot that I can still ache to think about it. So we're trying to find the Refusnik family, the Goldbergs, and they live, now I'm going to tell you their address though, just in case you're in Bukhara you can stop by. They live at 8 Zagorodnaya. And my partner and I, my partner is now a Rebbetzin on Long Island, we're wandering around the streets of Bukhara trying to look cool, but trying to find our way, and we are slowly, painfully mouthing every street sign we see because they're in Cyrillic, and we don't read Cyrillic so good. And we're sounding out, and we cannot find Zagorodnaya. And after about an hour of this, I mean, it was really dangerous at that point because it was very hot. We were thoroughly dehydrated. And Maureen and I decided it was time to go back to the hotel, which was, again, the largest structure in Bukhara. We couldn't see it anymore because it was only four stories. So there we were, lost in downtown Bukhara. Before leaving the hotel, I had actually taken the hotel card with me because I anticipated the possibility of having to do an idiot dumb show and just, you know, point to the card and gesture. The only problem was what I hadn't anticipated was no one would talk to us. We were so patently Westerners that to talk to us was to invite trouble. For all I know, someone was visibly following us, but only the Russians could see it and I couldn't. Or I suppose the Uzbeks could see and I couldn't. And we were really getting desperate. We couldn't find Zagorodnaya. We couldn't find our way to our hotel. And almost out of nowhere appears an old man wearing a long kaftan down to the ground, a black thing with a long beard, and a Bukharan yarmulke, literally carrying a walking stick, hunched over, a bit of a hook nose. He could have been a caricature from, you know, old Jew in Russia. And I went to him to ask about our hotel, and I do not know to this day what possessed me to, instead of saying, where is the hotel, saying, Gdzie ulica Zagorodnaya? Where is Zagorodnaya Street? And he memorably went, that was all I needed. I was like, great, we're with you. And we followed this guy, and he talked to us nonstop. I think it was Uzbek. Might have been Tajik. Every now and again, it seemed polite to say da. I should point out, by the way, I also don't speak Russian, but at least that word I knew. And after about 40 minutes of wandering in and out of the maze of what I could only call the kasbah of Bukhara, he stops dead in his tracks and picks up his walking stick and majestically raps on a door. And on the door in faint chalk is the number 8. So I said, again, my pidgin Russian, 8 Zagorodnaya? I still have no idea how to say 8 in Russian. I couldn't count that high. And he finally turns and says, da. It didn't even dawn on me at the moment to think, how did he know the number? Because we emphatically did not mention the number. And so we mime him like, wait right here, wait here. And we open the door to what is a courtyard. And in the courtyard, there are about four or five shack-like houses. And I immediately, David will appreciate this as a professor of Talmud, realized that I had entered a courtyard almost precisely as it's described in the Babylonian Talmud. People with a shared well, chickens running around, little naked kids playing in the dirt, and other Russian or Uzbek speakers. We ask, Goldberg? They said, da-da, Goldberg. And good, now we know we're in the right place. And it, the whole transaction couldn't have taken more than 10 seconds. We go outside to thank our old man. Vanished. Gone. Just not there. I look down the street this way. No old man. I look down this way. No old man. And then I notice that this way, the street has a little dog's leg. So I run to that piece of the street, and I look, and still, no old man. He has vanished into thin air. I make my way back to Eitz Zagorodnaya, and using the dictionary and in mime, we find out that, yes, this is where the Goldbergs live, but in fact, they're not in right now. This, of course, made us nervous, because we were worried, what does that mean, not in right now? Not in right now like they'll be back later, or not in like now because the KGB arrested them, or not in right now because but from the time we left New York to the time they got here, they made Aliyah. So again, through mime, we tell people very patiently, we'll be back. Let the Goldbergs know they have American visitors, we'll be back. And then we realize we're lost once more because who the hell knows where the hotel is? And we're in Eitz Zagorodnaya. So I say to a little kid, maybe 10 years old, in the courtyard, Gidye Hotel, whatever it was called, Bukhara, probably some clever name like that, and hand him the card. He reads the card and he looks up at me, and my first thought was he was illiterate because he looked at me like I was speaking Swahili and maybe that I was an idiot. Turned out it was the latter. He thought I was an idiot. So again, no response. So I say again, Gidye, and he literally takes me by the hand like I'm slow. And he walks with me the 20 paces to the dog's leg. And as I turn the angle, the kid goes, and I look up, and there's the hotel. I think, like, this is just really not fair. Because I know that I read every street sign as I passed, and I know that I must have passed the street. So then it dawns on me, maybe this little curve, the dog's leg, has a different street name. And sure enough, it did. It wasn't Zagorodnaya. So I was relieved. On the other hand, I knew I was going to come back later for Goldberg. I had to find the right street. And I sound out from the Russian what the name of the little dog's leg of the street is. And the name of the street is Shalomo Alechema. I'm like, this is like a little too good to be true. Turned out it was the Jewish ghetto. They had named the street after actually the writer Shalom Aleichem. And I really was an idiot. I just could not find myself there. So that's my story. And I'm sticking to it. And I've told it many times since 1977. But I want to say, and here I remember fondly my English professor from my undergraduate years at the University of Illinois at Chicago, that I am what is called an unreliable narrator. Why am I an unreliable narrator? Why shouldn't you trust my version of this story? Well, first of all, because I'm the hero of this story. Well, maybe not the hero, but the protagonist. Second of all, as I literally, and I have to confess this to you, as I was in the story myself, as it happened to me, because this really did happen, I was thinking of myself as rather James Bondish. Right, I grew up reading Ian Fleming. Here I was in a foreign country using a different passport, trying to help someone get out of Russia. I had this woman at my side. At the moment, she looked attractive like a James Bond girl. Everything fit for me, that template. Had the music started playing in the background, I wouldn't have been surprised. But in retelling the story year after year after year, and I hope you felt a little bit of it, I began to focus on the old man. And it struck me that that old man, in some very large measure, fulfills the obligations of Elijah. And the Elijah stories in rabbinic literature do actually form a type, particularly in the Talmud, in the Babylonian Talmud. In the Babylonian Talmud, Elijah comes to rescue rabbis. Elijah comes to rescue rabbis who are doing good deeds. Elijah comes out of nowhere and disappears. And he often comes in the guise of those who, with whom the rabbis are interacting. Let me give you an example, and for this you'll forgive me. I'm actually going to turn to this wonderful book. Here's a story about a great Babylonian rabbi, Rav Kahana. Rav Kahana was reduced by poverty to selling wicker baskets in the women's marketplace. That's like falling really low in the Babylonian patriarchal male scheme of things. In the marketplace, a certain woman importunes Rav Kahana for favors, shall we say. Rav Kahana was poor, and she thought she could hit on an easy mark. He said to her, well, wait, I'd like to go get myself pretty for you. He ran home, ran up on the roof, and flung himself off the roof rather than succumb to his libido. Elijah came and caught him midair. And then Elijah rebuked him. He said, Kahana, you have troubled me to travel 400 miles to catch you. And Rav Kahana said, is it my fault I have to sit here in the marketplace open to temptation? It's my poverty. At which point, Elijah gave him a jar of gold coins. So this is a fairly typical Elijah story in the Talmud. And I do confess it's not exactly the same as my story. But let me give you one more example. And this story is really a very well-known story. That there was a need for the Jewish community to bribe a certain Roman officer. And, you know, when you send a bribe, it's often a delicate operation. You can't be too obvious. You can't be too not obvious. You have to be able to make the payoff in sometimes a subtle fashion. So the rabbis asked a very famous rabbinic teacher named Nachum of Gamzo. Gamzo means this too. Gamzo, by the way, Gimzo is also a place name in the Bible, so it's a real name. They settled on Nachum because, in fact, he was deft, they say, melumad benisim. He was experienced in doing miracles. Nachum goes off with his sack of precious gems and gold, and when he is on his journey, as inevitably happens in these stories, he had to stay overnight at an inn. Right, we're in the realm of folklore. You kind of know what's going to happen. In the inn that night, Nachum is soundly sleeping. The innkeepers, those thieves, take his bag, empty all the gems out, and fill the bag with dirt. Nachum wakes up the next morning and innocently goes on his way to the Roman court to give his bribe. He gets there, he sets down his sack, he makes his transaction, and when the Roman officer opens the sack, he immediately concludes that the Jews are making fun of him, that it's known that he takes bribes, and he gives a command to execute Nachum and all the Jews. Well, this is a sad turn of the tale. Enter Elijah. Elijah, the Talmud says, appeared as though he were a Roman courtier. And he says to this Roman officer, oh, that dirt must be the dirt of their ancestor Abraham. Because it's well known, it says in the prophet Isaiah, that the dust turns to swords, the stubble turns to arrows. As it happens, by the way, that line of Isaiah from my bar mitzvah Haftorah. The Roman grandee says, really? You think this dirt's like a secret weapon? Well, let's test it out. And he goes to this town that he's been besieging, and sure enough, it works. So he comes back to the court, and he takes Nahum's sack, now empty of this special dirt, and he fills it with precious gems and gold and sends him away with this great pomp and circumstance. Nahum has to go back home now. He gets to the same inn, and they see he's being accompanied by officers. He's wealthy now beyond imagination, and they say, "What happened?" And Nahum says, "I don't know. What I took from here, I brought there." So, how does the story end, of course? That those innkeepers tear down the inn, stuff everything they can into sacks, and bring it to this Roman officer to offer a bribe. And he says, "What's this?" They say, "This is the dirt he brought you." And once again, he tests the dirt. But this time, it doesn't work. And the happy ending to the story is that the Roman officer killed those innkeepers. So, again, not quite my tale. Not quite my tale. But, again, you know, you're there. You have Elijah appear on the scene. I could make an argument that I was there on a mission trying to help the Jews, etc., etc. I have been, by that time, in 1977, I was already 5 years in JTS, totally schooled in Midrash, and inclined to see the world that mythic way. One last story, if you will, and it's going to involve a character some of you know. Rabbi Akiva, who was, as you may know in rabbinic legend, a poor shepherd. And as often happens to poor shepherds, he got engaged to the daughter of a very wealthy man. This actually happens most frequently to poor shepherds when they're dreaming at night. But the very wealthy man named Ben Kalba Savua, his would-be father-in-law, is very unhappy about the match and vows to disinherit the girl. By the way, Ben Kalba Savua, let me just translate this accurately into English. Ben, son of, Kalba, anyone?
Dog.
Dog, what kind of dog?
A female.
Female dog. Savua, satisfied. Right? So the rich man's name is actually the satisfied son of a bitch. I mean, it's just great. You know you're in legend when the rich guy's called that. The girl loves Akiva. Akiva loves the girl. They get married, and they live in abject poverty. Akiva says to his bride, "If I could, honey," actually the honey's not Natala, "I would adorn you with a tiara of gold shaped like the skyline of Jerusalem." And that night, Elijah came to them in the guise of a poor man. He knocked on the door and begged them for a bit of straw. And when they asked him why, he said, "My wife is about to give birth, and she doesn't even have a pile of straw to rest on." And so Akiva said to his wife, kind of dwelling on the obvious, "Look, here's a man who doesn't even have straw." And, of course, I assume this means they felt better. They weren't the poorest people in the neighborhood. I suppose if we wanted to tell the story yet once more, she'd cut her hair and sell it. He'd buy her a comb. You know, you get the idea. These stories are very highly stylized. They are very quirky. They follow, actually, a fairly well-established set of rules. And, you know, it takes a while to get to know how they work. I like to joke because we all gossip about our clergy. Admit it. Come on. You do. Right? And it wouldn't it be nice if this is the way it actually worked? You gossip about your rabbi. You wait 500 years. Then it's sacred literature. Right? Alas, it doesn't work quite that simply. And the rabbis have a very, very typical style. I mean, I've already, in some ways, given you patterns that we know very well. If I say Bond, James Bond, you can tell me the rest of the story. You know, there's going to be a beautiful girl. You know, there's going to be a danger. You know, there's going to be, what is it they said in one of the movies? Gratuitous sex and violence, right? It's just, that's the pattern. If I tell you Elijah, most of you can figure out how it's going to work. Maybe there will be a bris involved. Maybe there will be a seder involved. But you know the Elijah patterns. If I tell you the gunslinger, again, we all know how to do the cowboy stories, which is where I actually got the title Sage Tales, because when I grew up, there was an actor, I think his name was Ronald Reagan.
Reagan.
And he hosted, I think it was called, was it Death Valley Days? Sponsored by 20 Mule Team Borax. And it was cowboy stories, and it was always about the purple sage. So I kind of grew up hearing Sage Tales, never did it dawn on me until I came to write this book, and I was thinking of a title that I knew an entirely different kind of sage tale. So, the question you should all ask about the book is, so why? Why bother telling these stories? These are stories that happened a long time ago. And the truth be told, these are stories that were often told a long time after the characters lived. So let me give you an example of that. One of the characters who recurs in this book is a rabbi by the name of Yochanan ben Zakkai. Now, some of you may have heard of him, and in rabbinic legend and rabbinic lore, he is often looked to as the founding father of rabbinic Judaism. But it's interesting that the Talmud, written almost 400 or 500 years after the death of Yochanan ben Zakkai, and in a very different country, in what we would now call Iraq, not the land of Israel, still tells the stories about Yochanan ben Zakkai and his escape from besieged Jerusalem as the temple goes up in flames. So I ask myself this as I'm teaching these stories and writing these stories. What's in it for them? Why do they continue to tell a story about something that happened a long, long time ago in a faraway place? And it strikes me that as they tell the tale, in the ways in which they tell it, and in the ways in which they change the story as they tell it, what they're really telling is their own story. Let me give you an example. I can't do math very well. Uh-huh. 1770, 1760, 1750. How long ago was that?
A long time ago.
A long time ago. I'm trying to remember when George Washington was a small boy. 1730, is that when he was born?
Yeah.
All right, so let's make it 1742, when he was 6 years old.
He was 10.
He was 10?
He was 10. 1732. He was 10.
Okay. 10 is also good. And at age 10, he had a little accident. That doesn't help me, John. But I don't know what. Now I'll know the Baal Shem Tov was born in the year of George Washington. If I can remember that, I'm in shape. But he had a little accident in the backyard. Some of you know about it. There was a cherry tree.
Oh, yes.
Right? We all know the story. He went to his father. He said, "Father, I cannot tell a lie. I chopped down the cherry tree." And his father did what? What did he do? Andrew, in your version, what did George Washington's father do?
Commended him for his honesty.
Commended him for his honesty. In any version of the story that you know, did his father whoop the hell out of him?
No.
Almost none of those versions. By the way, it's really interesting. In almost all the tellings of that story, the father never raises a hand in anger because he's so pleased. So what is the story? Why do we tell that story? First of all, let me ask something obvious that you may not have asked yourself. You think it happened?
No.
I mean, do any of us think it actually happened? Or that if something like it happened the way they tell it? No, it's didactic narrative. We take a great American hero, we tell a story about his childhood, and it's clearly told to illustrate the value of telling the truth at all cost. And you have to step forward. By the way, we rabbis, we Jews, we don't necessarily share that value. We don't. I'll give you an example, and I'll give you an example from the Torah, which the rabbis love trotting out. Sarah, you may remember she was an old lady. They were visited by angels, and the angels told her, "A year from now, you'll have a baby." And what did Sarah do?
Left.
She left because she was an old woman. And in fact, what she said to the angels at the moment was, I no longer menstruate, and my husband is old. Now, I don't want to go into what that means. It's one of those moments that, like, suddenly we realize we have way too much information about what's going on in their marriage. Like, I mean, really, what does it mean when a woman says, my husband's old? Like, okay. But the angels, when they come back to Abraham, and Abraham says, what's going on? The angels very discreetly say, Sarah left and said she was old. That's all they say. So the rabbis point out that every now and again, for the sake of shalom bayit, for household peace, you don't have to tell the whole story. Right? So it's a very different value. They value household peace above telling a white lie. So George Washington maybe wouldn't have, you know, done so well if Sarah was his wife. Oh, that's interesting to think about. I grew up in Illinois, and I grew up really on Abe Lincoln stories. I know dozens, if not hundreds, of Abe Lincoln stories. And again, I suspect none of them actually happen. But we tell them because we want to impart our values. Can I just tell one Abe Lincoln story?
Yeah.
They say that before he was president, when he was an attorney, a guy came to him. My wife's an attorney. Hi, Sandy. She's very faithful because she read the book a few times. And now she still comes and hears me talk about it. So Lincoln was in his office, and some guy comes to him and says, Mr. Lincoln, I understand you're really a very good attorney. And I committed such and such a crime. I need you to get me off. And Lincoln said, you don't understand, sir. If you tell me you're guilty, I can't defend you. And the guy said, well, I did do the crime, but I really need you to get me off this. I'll pay $100. And you may be able to do the math yourself. It was the year after the Baal Shem Tov. It was 1865, 62, 60, whenever. And $100 was worth a lot of money. And it was Union money, too. It wasn't Confederate money. And Lincoln says, sir, I really was fairly clear to you. I cannot represent you. And the guy says, no, I really need you to be my lawyer. I'll give you $200. And Lincoln said, I'm an attorney. I've taken an oath in court that I will defend the law, and I will defend you, but I can't defend a known felon. The guy says, Mr. Lincoln, I will give you $500, at which point Lincoln grabs him by the scruff of his neck and throws him down the stairs. From the bottom of the stairs, the guy says, I don't understand. You talked to me when I said $100. You talked to me when I said $200. How come at $500 you threw me down the stairs? And Lincoln said, you were getting close to my price. So again, I don't think that story actually happened the way we tell it. I don't think it happened at all, probably. But we tell it because of honest Abe. We tell it to teach values. And we tell the stories of the rabbis again and again to teach our values. We tell the story of the destruction of the Jerusalem temple, how that building, which was central to our self-image and central to our Jewish identity, went up in flames over 2 days. How Jerusalem fell and the temple was destroyed. We talk about the aftermath with the ashes floating in the air. And we tell vindictive, vicious stories about how ultimately God got even with the general who destroyed Jerusalem, Titus. I tell a story like that from the Talmud in this book. And I cannot then, and I certainly can't this week, talk about our own desire to fantasize vicious retribution against Titus, who, by the way, died a natural death, without thinking about a building we all saw fall and go up in flames and let the ashes settle, and finally retribution has been done. And horrified as I was to see people dancing in the streets about the death of Osama bin Laden, I understood, because I know rabbinic literature, I understood the desire, the fantasy, the urge to retribution. But I also understood that if you don't get past that urge to retribution, you're part of the tragedy, because the Talmud teaches us that as well. So stories like this are old stories. They took place a long time ago, and we tell them, and we retell them, and we re-retell them. And frankly, one of the reasons I'm happy to tell them is because I think they still hold enormous value for every one of us as human beings, whether we're Jewish or not. These are great ancient tales. Just like we tell stories of the saints. This week, a human being who we all knew, or at least read about in the newspaper, took a large step on the road to sainthood. And ultimately, John Paul will become a saint, and they will tell stories of the sainted John Paul. These are our saints. These are our hagiographa, our lives of the saints. And in telling these stories again and again and again, we tell ourselves. We discover who we are. We hold these tales up, and they are a mirror. It's almost like you're in the bathroom, you've taken a shower, and you need to wipe off the mirror to see yourself. And these are the stories, and you learn how they can reflect who you are as you read them. I just want to end with one last story that I tell here in the book. It's a story that's told many times, just like I mentioned George Washington's age, and I got, he's 6 years old, he's 10 years old. In this particular story, it's about a story named Rabbi Eliezer. And Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus became one of the greatest rabbis in the Talmud. As it turns out, he had a tragic death, but we won't talk about that. But it's a nice tease, isn't it? The story goes that Eliezer came to study late in life. In one version of the story, he's 28. In one version of the story, he's 22. And in one version of the story, his age is not given, although it appears from the story that he's a fairly young boy. And I always marvel at why the ages would differ in each retelling of the story. And the professor in me thinks that it depended on whether he was teaching undergraduates or graduate students, right? You're teaching undergrads, you say, oh, he's 22, and they all think, ooh, I started earlier. You get to graduate students, you got to up the ante a little bit. And I suppose if it were this crowd, I'd have him start at 60. Right? Because everybody in the room is somewhere in that age range. But when my daughter, who is now pushing 30, and is happily married and lives far away, and actually is the illustrator of one of the pictures in the book. When my daughter was an infant, I used to tell her these stories. These were our bedtime tales. And she, I am sure why. In the story of Eliezer and how he came to study Torah, the whole first part of the story is about Eliezer crying at the drop of a hat. Like, anything goes wrong, he starts to cry. And I think my daughter sympathized with that. She was not, what's the nice word? She was not easy. And she used to cry all the time. So I think she thought Eliezer was his soulmate. But she was little. And so when she'd cuddle up in bed with me, and she'd want a story, she would say to me, Abba, tell me the story of ravioli. And it took me a little while to figure out what she meant, but finally I understood it was not pasta she was asking for. It was the story of our great sage, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. You will find that this narrative, I've made the book in 22 chapters, one for each letter of the Hebrew alphabet. At the back of the book, there's a glossary, so you know the terms. There's a who's who, so you know who's who. And I have taken all the texts out so that you can read them just as text without my commentary. You can do that before, during, or after. Or if you want to do your book club or your study group or your synagogue group or your church group, you can study them separately. I wanted this to be a book that was very user-friendly. But I think we have time for some questions.
Ooh, yeah.
And some comments or brief speeches. I thank you for your attention. Sir.
What happened to the
Goldsteins? Yes. I thank you for asking that question, actually. I was tasked to visit 8 different families. And we were taught not to write anything down, and we needed to bring certain information back so that the Israelis could find cousins to invite them to come make Aliyah. We needed to know the family, the patronymic, the father's name. We needed to know the date of birth and the locale. And it turned out that I was able to memorize that kind of information for 8 different families. We had an interest guide who stuck with us almost like glue. But for each time we went to visit the families, we managed to ditch her. And it obviously became clear after a while that she must have figured out what we were doing. On the last day of our tour, she said to me, "My name is Mira Abdueva, and I know that sounds like a Muslim name, I'm a Bukharan, but Mira is actually short for Miriam. My father's name is, my birthday is, and here's where I live." So we came out with 9 names. All 9 families got out, all 9 families moved to Israel. And I have to say, that's the last I heard of them. For all I know, they're all living in Queens now. But, my story was a story with really a very happy ending. And indeed, yes, the Goldbergs, not their real name. Although it may be now, they ended well. Thank you. Other questions, sir?
Well, this is a comment. I remember reading about that story of George Washington, and the first reference to that story was about 1820. And I forgot the name of the author who wrote it.
Orson Welles.
On the life of George Washington, so it was about 25 years after he died.
Yeah, I'm willing to bet that when Yochanan ben Zakkai was alive, they weren't necessarily telling the same stories. And it took more than a generation to tell versions of the stories. To this day, by the way, and I talk about this in the book, there's a very famous story about Yochanan ben Zakkai sneaking out of besieged Jerusalem. Some of you know it. And to this day, I cannot for myself figure out whether that story is meant in praise of Yochanan ben Zakkai or as criticism of Yochanan ben Zakkai for sneaking out and leaving everyone behind. You know, there's always more than one way to read, and that's kind of the fun of this. When we're reading stories that were told largely orally for 500, 600, 700, 1,000 years, and then they're written down, it's very hard to know how to decode them. It requires every one of us to enter the story and become an active reader and to reflect on it. And of course, the more we reflect, the way we read tells you about where you are as you read the story. Did you have a question?
Yes. As you illustrated did with the stories Lincoln and Washington, there are lots of stories that can be used as examples.
Absolutely.
Values and so on. Why are these stories, why do they have such staying power?
The short answer, for me, I'm Jewish. These define my Jewish identity. I am a rabbi. I identify very powerfully with the founding rabbis, how they found their way, how they basically had to take a moment in time. We're still reading Vayikra, right? Now, for those of you that go to the synagogue and are reading Leviticus, you know what it's all about, animal sacrifice in the Jerusalem temple. Can I point out, unless you have a very unusual shul, we don't do that anymore. Although it is nice to contemplate. And now the bar mitzvah boy will shech the ox. It would solve the catering problem. But we underwent an enormous change. The trauma of 70, of the destruction of the temple, required us to reinvent Judaism. And we reinvented something that was essentially very Hellenistic. We became a people of the book. We did commentary. And it shifted the power locus from the priesthood to a whole new class of people who previously didn't exist. Anybody in the room know who is the earliest person referred to in literature with the title rabbi?
Jesus.
Yes, Jesus of Nazareth. Chew on that for a while. it's really an uncanny thing. At that moment, by the way, the gospel that refers to Jesus, when they transliterate in the Greek, rabbi, into Greek, and they know it's not a Greek word, they actually define it as didaskalos, teacher. That's what we usually think a rabbi is, but that's not what it means in biblical Hebrew. So it's all also the earliest definition of what a rabbi is. That story about Jesus was written also post-70. In the very moment of the emergence of rabbinic Judaism, the early Christian community imagined Jesus as a rabbi. And we imagined Yochanan ben Zakkai as a rabbi and Eliezer as a rabbi. For me, that moment of birth constantly requires me as a teacher, as a rabbi, to think, A, how do I measure up? B, how would I do Judaism? Because all of us in the room, whether you're Jewish or you're Christian, kind of every day, you are figuring out what choices you make about your own identity. One of the greatnesses of America, and one of the great flaws of America, is the incredible freedom we have to invent ourselves daily. So these stories really speak to my heart and connect me to literally 2,000 years of rabbinic Jewish identity.
You mentioned the destruction of the Second Temple being this cataclysmic event. You don't mention the first temple and the destruction of that, almost as if you're just almost disregarding it.
I am. I am for two reasons. Yeah. Number one, the first temple, the Bible actually deals with. And the interesting thing about rabbinic Judaism is references to the destruction of the first temple, like the Book of Lamentations, are often read by rabbis as though it was their own temple that was destroyed. They conflate the two. The second reason is one of false humility. I'm not a Bible scholar. And because I'm not a Bible scholar, I don't know anything about what happened in 586 BC. I know a lot about what happened in 70, right? It's the wrong century for me. It's that simple. Right, Sandy? I'm not a Bible scholar. Anyone else? Yes, sir.
I'm not sure how to phrase this. I've read about it in the book, so I'm not sure you cover this. But there's the famous story of Rabbi Eliezer at the time he becomes excommunicated, where his difference with the rabbi...
Don't give it away, okay?
Oh, it's my favorite topic.
Okay. So you know, you can tell the story, but the question is, a lot of the stories you tell are almost believable because they're people. You know, Elijah shows up as a person and something happens. But here, it's mystical. It's, you know, God speaks at the wall.
I'm glad you asked that, because you're quite right. There's a whole cycle of rabbinic stories that deal with mysticism. And, you know, we have our own flirtations with mysticism today. Anybody wearing a little red band around their wrist? Or anybody listen to Madonna? Or, you know, you maybe do yoga or you meditate. Our paths to spirituality are different than theirs. But the truth is there are many stories, even about Yochanan ben Zakkai and his disciples, where mystical, weird things happen. Paul knows. He was in a class with me, and we read stories about the heavens opening. And I translated actually in the book, because I do deal with two or three chapters about rabbinic mysticism. But one of my favorite stories, one of the rabbis is giving a discourse on mysticism. And it's so interesting that the angels come down from heaven. And the only way I can translate it is that they're crowding around like Jews elbowing each other out of the way at a Long Island wedding smorgasbord. You know, it's like just really, they actually use a Persian word to, wake up there, Persian word, to describe, which is why I use the word smorgasbord, because it's also Persian. there are moments that strain our credibility, that make us understand that, yes, these are stories about rabbis, but sometimes they are tall tales. Sandy and I have a house up in Connecticut. And on the way to the house, not really about 5 miles from our house, there's a furniture company, Hunt Country Furniture. And for probably a decade, in front of the place, they had this gigantic chair. It must have been 30 feet high. A beautiful chair. And when my son was young, he and a friend of his, who I'll call Sam, were in the car. And as we ride by, I say to Sam, "You see that chair? That's Paul Bunyan's chair. Now, my son, who grew up with me, knew better. But Sam, who did not, said, "Really? I didn't know he was a real person. But now he's seen the chair." So obviously, you know, and I felt a little bad. But on the way home, I had to disabuse Sam, lest he tell his father that I was...
He works for Goldman Sachs now.
Yes, indeed. Which tells you that he can believe almost anything.